Welcome to PhD Careers in Life Sciences podcast, brought to you by the Office of Postdoctoral Affairs at NUS Medicine. We don't need more people who give quick answers. We need more leaders who ask the right question. This quote comes from today's special guest, Dr. Daniel Mahazer, and it captures the wisdom and values that guide his work all this while. Daniel wears many hats: researcher, founder, CEO, investor, academic leader, and activist. His career is anything but linear. It weaves together academia, business, and volunteer leadership in ways that are both inspiring and unconventional. Currently an innovation fellow at the Singh Health Duke NUS Global Health Institute, Daniel works at the intersection of food security, digital health, and climate action. Beyond academia, Daniel is also director of research and development at Adyenta Corporation, where he leads investments in sustainable food production and agritech, with a vision to strengthen food security in Southeast Asia. His story shows that a PhD career doesn't have to follow a straight line. It can be colorful, impactful, and full of surprises. Daniel, I'm so excited to welcome you to this podcast.
Thank you, Aim. Thanks for the really nice introduction of myself.
So given that we are pretty familiar with each other already, I want to start with a slightly provocative question. Are you ready?
Yeah, sure.
So, as a PhD graduate in public health, you're passionate about so many areas: climate change, healthy longevity, nutrition, innovation, investment, among other things. Have you ever felt lost or doubt yourself whether you lack focus?
Yeah, that's an amazing question. So a lot of people actually ask me similar question as well. But I think my main primary interest lies in between health and also climate. So how do we actually preserve our health and how do we protect our home, which is planet Earth, right? The remaining topics I've been working on are probably the facet that supports these two things, health and climate. In terms of investment, business and everything, because as I grow up, I realized one thing: money is what makes the world go around. And in a lot of my advocacy work in climate especially, unless if it affects the economy, it actually doesn't move a needle at all. So that's why a lot of time I realized, in order for us to actually create changes in both health and climate, we need to speak the same language as policymakers, as industry leader, and so on. And that is why I feel like you can see that all of my work actually spreads out. But technically, if you look from a bird point of view, actually support these two things, which is health and climate. And that's why I always say that I work from end to end, from the knowledge acquisition, how do you implement it, how you translate it, how do you evaluate it. And then the final one is that how do you actually sell the good work that you do to the public? Because Einstein said, if you can't explain to the 5-year-old, you really don't understand what you're doing, right? And I feel like the public, not to say that they are 5-year-old, but you actually have to speak the language that they understand, like what are the problems that they're facing and what are the solutions that you're offering. And a lot of time when we do science, we're actually creating solutions after understanding the problem, right? And I feel like that is the work that is that little extension that I do on top of my main job as a scientist. So yeah, the problem with focus doesn't really arise. It's just, how do you map it out together?
Right, and yeah, thank you. Thank you for explaining all the interconnections between all the, everything, and also emphasize on the two keywords, health and climate, which is what you focus on.
Yeah.
No problem. Your career actually spans academia, entrepreneurship, R&D, and advocacy. I feel that it's been done in a rather unconventional way. Could you walk us, could you walk us through your scientific journey from the start up to now?
So my scientific journey, I mean, it was instilled by my PhD supervisor who was trying to convince me to do PhD. I think more than 7 years ago. And she was actually the one that made me trying to make me understand what is the value of doing a PhD, what's the value of having that certificate, being called a scientist and so on, because I love knowledge and and a PhD is sort of like solidifying my credibility of someone who loves knowledge. And I started my academic journey when I was doing my undergrads at RMIT Melbourne, Australia, where I was focusing more on food system and nutrition. And then after that, I moved to molecular medicine. And then finally, I did my PhD in Monash University, focusing specifically on public health. And this is when I understand how do we actually translate all the hardcore sciences into the public. And how do we actually create changes in the within the community and within a like beyond the walls of our lab and so on. And from there, actually, my entrepreneurship journey started in the middle of my PhD journey, where I met three good friends when I was in Australia. We decided to really understand how do we actually translate food and nutrition, food system into something that is profitable in Malaysia back home. And that this is based on our observation when we were in Australia, because Australia is one of the larger ag agriculture industry in the world, and they have like all this advanced technology for cattle farming, for agriculture and so on. And this is something that actually amazed us. And then we tried to bring the idea back into Malaysia, but what we didn't do is actually to understand what does agriculture in Malaysia mean. And that's why we went back to Malaysia, and then we realized, oh, there's a lot of pivoting, there's a lot of contextualizing that we need to be to do before actually introduce all this technology and so on. And then and that's actually that is why the scientific journey and entrepreneurship journey is sort of intertwined. And at the end of my PhD, actually on my final day, final year of my PhD, I started to feel lesser and lesser interested in my PhD because at that time I was busy building my own business. And then I realized, oh, I didn't really need this, you know? And then my supervisor then, he has, she, both of them, has been very persistent and reminding me like, hey, this is the last mile. Let's just give it a go. And it doesn't, you won't lose anything, right? So I took 3 months off from my business building thing to just focus on writing my thesis. And yeah, here I am. And I'm very thankful to them who actually like keep on supporting me in many, many ways on finishing my PhD. And I think, they are correct because I didn't lose a lot of things. PhD actually was the time where I practiced my discipline, my focus power, and my thirst for knowledge, but in a very structured way, right? If you have a great supervisor, you really have a leader that will guide you on doing a lot of things and how do you learn new things? How do you unlearn? Old things and so on. And this is very, very important. And I'm so glad that I have like amazing supervisors and yeah, thankful to them for doing what they are doing and then for making me where I am right now.
No regret taking that 3 months off from your business to complete your PhD.
No, not really. Like that 3 months paid well. Yeah.
I guess where you are today is also partially attributed to the PhD journey
Mm-hmm.
that you have done, as well as the PhD degree that you have gotten, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Cool. So after your PhD, you could focus completely on your business, or you were looking for a postdoc, and then how did you balance it? I look at your LinkedIn profile. I had to say that I could not comprehend it completely.
After my PhD, I think that is why in building a business and doing a PhD is sort of similar but different in a way too. It's similar in a way that I was successful in my PhD because I have a teamwork. I have a great teamwork with me and my supervisor and also my lab mates at that point. And then when I was doing my business, I had a great founding team, and four of us has always been, committed about setting up this business and wanting to do a lot of things in reshaping what is food system and agriculture in Malaysia. And then when I finished my PhD, it just took a little because it was a last mile for us before we actually solidified the first startup idea and then get like the first, actually the second round of funding, and then eventually moving towards exit. And that is when I actually took a, I think probably a year before I was looking for my postdoc, which brought me to Singapore. And then when we first exited, and when the entrepreneurship journey was like, starting to pace off and everything, and I thought like, oh, maybe I shouldn't stop. I'm too young to retire. So that's why I was like, okay, what do I want to do next? A lot of people, they went on and start their second company, and then working on their second idea. But then I decided to actually take a pause and then go back to the to academia.
We'll talk a little bit more about your startup journey later on in a later question. Now, coming back to academia, so there must be some kind of attachment that you of like the emotional attachment that you have with academia, right? Many people, once they go into industry or business or the entrepreneurship journey, they would not want to come back to academia again. But you actually, instead of following through that journey, the entrepreneurship track, you decided to come back and be a postdoc. And I don't think it's driven by salary as a postdoc. So I think there must be something else that drove your decision.
I think, to be honest, it's also like, what do I wanna get next in my life, right? I really like whole head as entrepreneurship. I already whole heads as a CEO. I already whole heads as a I mean, like, it's in terms of startup, it's already there. And then I feel like if I want to start my next company, and then I need to go back to the grind and so on. And I it's not that I wanted to stop doing that. I just want to take a pause for a while. And the reason why I went back to postdoc, I just realized that I actually, during my journey as an entrepreneur, I still read scientific journal. I still want to know a lot of things. I still, and that's why I'm leading the research and development part of my company, because I want to know like the rational of all of our operations, our management, our decision, and so on. And that's why I realized, oh, maybe I need to go back. Maybe academy is not really a bad idea as my next step. And it takes a lot of decision with my co-founders as well. Like, there's a lot of discussion and, trying to come up whether what's good for us, right? So that's why it's a lot of teamwork. It's a lot of deliberation. It's never a lonely journey. And I think it's similar in being in academia as well, right? There's like an ecosystem around you that you have to consider what actually benefit, who actually benefit, who actually gonna take an impact, and so on. And I would like to understand, like, I think salary in academia is not that bad, and I mean, like, it's not high, but it's stable. And then if you're in entrepreneurship, it's probably going to be lucrative at some point, but it's risky, right? You can wake up the next morning and P&L is negative or something like that. And I think there's a give and take that you need to do and you need to consider. And I feel like every job in the world has their own risk. And yeah, you just have to pick your battle. And I don't think it's mostly motivated about salary, but it's just motivated by my attitude towards knowledge. Yeah. And that's why I just feel like postdoc is such a nice journey as to the next chapter of my life. And I don't know, maybe I'm going back to entrepreneurship soon. I don't know.
You really embrace the uncertainty, I feel.
Yes, yeah. You're riding the uncertain white. Yeah.
I'm so thankful that you mentioned several important points, including the compensation that people view that in academia is not that great, but actually in entrepreneurship, it can be very good, but it can also be very bad. Really high risk there. I also appreciate that you are sending the message to many of us in academia who felt that they are not making impact. You are actually showing them that the reason why you come back to academia is actually because you want an impact. If you want to drive innovation, you want to drive your enterprise, you need science to back it up. And you really want to set aside your time to invest on going deeper into the science or advancing science so that you have something to advance in the business world as well. So
Correct, yeah.
thank you. In the academic part itself, right? Many people assume that if you want to pursue academic career, you will either become a professor who focus on research or become a lecturer who focus on teaching. But your path is different. Can you describe what you do in your current role at Duke NUS for our audience?
Oh, okay. As an innovation fellow, what we're trying to do, again, this is borrowing from my experience as an entrepreneurship. What we're trying to do is actually to build an ecosystem that is safe enough or supportive enough for people who work in academy to venture out into a proper entrepreneurship. And that's what we're trying to do. And then, it's really about creating an ecosystem for our healthcare cluster, which is my case, Sing Health, to empower all of the medical doctors and also medical students to spearhead their own innovation journey into creating a fundable solution. Fundable solution, and what I meant by that is a prototype or an idea that actually can generate investment from probably industry, venture capital, and many other things. And a lot of time, what we're working on is we created a hackathon, and then I run a 6-month fellowship journey for people that comes everywhere across Asia Pacific to really look into what are the next frontier of healthcare and medicine. And then how do we actually translate that into creating a company, a startup, or just merging the idea with an existing ecosystem that they already have? And it's really about creating a network of people that actually support you to translate your idea from academic into industry. And this is what I think I'm very passionate about right now, because that actually merged my previous experience as an entrepreneurship to my existing domain, which is science and the market. And this is very, very interesting at this point. So far now, we have incubated like three ideas that actually going everywhere. Like one of our ideas has won a startup competition in Vienna, and then two of them are actually coming back to Singapore for another round of pitch to big industries like Microsoft, Singapore Deep Tech Alliance, and so on. And they're actually being very, committed and actually comes to at the same juncture as me. Do they want to stay in science, or do they want to start their company, and so on? And that is just really inspiring to me. As much as I'm sharing my experience with them, like I'm getting more and more inspired by working with them as well. Yeah.
Really nice. It's like you're training the next generation of students, but it's not the students in the traditional sense, but more like the next gen entrepreneurs. And you
Yes,
also
yeah.
find it very fulfilling to see more and more of them growing and venture out successfully.
And our focus is on global health, which is very, very interesting because we are trying to bridge Singapore with all of the regional markets around the world who probably have a less effective or less optimized healthcare system in the world. I mean, in the country. And we're trying to improvise from their point of view. How do we innovate within their healthcare system and how do we support them as an economic power here in Singapore? And that is very inspiring because we are actually completing the puzzle, right? Because if we are
Yeah.
not helping our neighbors and no one is going to help them.
Yeah, that's true. I would like to swap the questions a little bit since
Sure.
we are on this topic. So, because your journey is so interesting, and I can imagine some of our listeners already started questioning or having this question in their mind, like how can they become like you? What kind of skill sets would they need to be in a position like you to drive to drive innovation from academia to the business world?
Oh, okay. So one, you have to be very teachable and you have to be really willingly understand that there's a limit to your knowledge and you always need to like dig down on the topics that you don't know. And that's one of the skill set that actually brought me a long way now because I always ask a lot of questions to people. I always join a lot of talks, just really getting some inspiration from people who already made it in the industry or big professors who already be very successful in academia. And I don't really say like, oh, I'm just gonna go to the startup event or something like that. I go to everything, like some academic lectures, some startup mixers, anything, hackathon, sharing and journal club, just let me know I'll be there kind of thing. And then within the topic that you are interested in, for instance, for myself is health and climate. And then just go around and ask people about what they have done and then take inspiration from their work and identifying what could be done better, optimizing and everything. And probably, like start building idea lab for yourself, right? I have a notebook where I jot down everything that I reflect on the day itself. And from that, I think the next skill set is to be to is for communication. And you have to really understand that not everyone speak like a scientist, right? You have to understand, especially people who are in the industry, in the economic sector, most of the time they speak dollar and cents. And you have to really acquire that skill of being able to speak to the public, to the lawmaker, to the industry leader and so on. And communication is a lifelong learning process. It's not that you can go to a class one day and the next day you know how to communicate better. And I have been friends with people who work on media, people, journalists and so on. And then most of the time I ask them, what's your opinion about my talk? And then and so on. It's just like that skill set is just a lifelong journey. Because I started as a very nerdy student as well. I only hide myself in the lab and I don't really talk to people. And then now I think you know me, Im. I'm like gathering everyone for lunch and then we're gonna have like, some discourse, some random talks and so on. So that's the second skill. And then the third skill is that you have to be very analytical. And this skill I think is not foreign for a lot of scientists. But you have to be analytical to the right things. You have to understand, read the market, read your society, understand your neighbor, what are the problems that they're facing on day-to-day basis. And then from there, you can actually start creating idea that is relevant to the public. Yeah. So reading the room is a very important part because as someone who has a PhD, when we enter the room, we always tend to have this feeling that, oh, I'm above everyone. I know everything. I know better, you know, kind of thing. But no, not really, because most of the time when you enter to a room where there's new people that you don't know, they will know a lot of things that you don't know. And that is something that you need to learn from everyone, right? And reading the room and understanding your environment and surrounding is something that is very valuable for me. And the final one, I think, is actually to network with people who has already, what's the word? Has already established themselves in the ecosystem. You know, if you meet someone from Temasek Trust, Temasek Foundation, just be friend with them, understand what are sort of support that Singapore is providing for the people who's working here. If you meet people from Microsoft or from other tech companies, and then understand what sort of ecosystem that they're really building for innovators and so on. And I think these four things is very important. The first one is like I think it's worth repeating that you need to be very teachable. And second, you need to be an effective communicator. Third one, you need to be a great room reader. You need to understand what is happening around the world, be aware about the global affairs and so on. And finally, just an effective networker will bring you everywhere.
Your answer is extensive but very, very structured. And I want to tell our listeners that this question was not in on the list before. So Daniel, I did not give Daniel time to prepare for this question. So I just asked him out of the blue, and he was able to give us this kind of answer immediately. So it was very impressive. Thank you, Daniel. And that also emphasized, I think, both your analytical skills and also the communication skills that you emphasize as well. Next question. Tell us the secret of how you maintain your self-confidence and optimism towards the future when facing so many uncertainties in your profession. What do you think are some of the biggest contributors to your present success? I would call it success. I don't think I'm exaggerating it.
I think you're exaggerating it. I still feel like I'm still in my journey to success. My biggest how do I deal with uncertainty is to know that if the uncertainty is something that I can control, I need to know where is the lever, where is the button, where's the switch to control. If the uncertainty is something that I couldn't control, and most of the time we don't know whether we know you can control or not, I just let it go. Yeah. So, for instance, I use the dimension of time. If I can deal with this problem for 2 weeks and I can find a solution to it, then I will work towards the solution. If after 2 weeks or a month, I don't really know what's the answer towards it, I just like feel like, okay, maybe I'm not the best person to solve this problem. And then I didn't actually let it go completely, but I direct the problem to someone who I think might have the skill set or might have the capacity to solve this problem. And this is very lit I mean this is an analogy to it, but then in life it's going to present itself in many many other ways. And then what are my contributors is the first one is I have very supportive parents. Family. Both my mom and dad are entrepreneurs themselves. So they are the one that actually inspired me to become an entrepreneur. When I got my PhD, and then I was telling my dad, hey, I completed my PhD. And my dad was like, oh, okay, what's next? Because he doesn't understand the value of PhD, right? But then for him, the biggest value in life is actually how many people you help in your life. Yeah, how many people has actually benefited from your work? And my dad always asked me that. And it take me like probably more than 10 times of telling him what is my PhD project. And for him to understand, oh, okay, it's nutrition. Oh, it's public health. Oh, what is public health? Is it like, you know, everyone going to the hospital? Yeah, kind of thing. But they are like my biggest inspiration. And the second one is actually The second contributor is my friends, right? And if you know me, I am very selective to people who are going to be very close with me. I don't befriend with everybody because your closest five friends is the reflection of your attitude. And if you befriend with a lot of people who are very pessimistic, very negative about the world, you tend to be like that too. And if you want to be very successful in science, entrepreneurship, and so on, then find these five people that you can learn and having a discussion or debate with, because they will actually support you or being or challenge you from being comfortable with your current status, right? And up until now, I can happily say that I have like a very strong group of friends, and you included, Aim, right? I always like, text you if I have some question and everything, because I know at any point, you are very open to give advice and everything. And I think all of my friends are like that too. And that is the biggest contributor that I have. And the third one is being in the right ecosystem. One of the reasons why I decided to move to Singapore is also because Singapore is a very competitive environment. A lot of people take it wrongly. They're like, oh, you're gonna work 24/7 in Singapore. But no, I feel like if you know how to navigate ways over here, Singapore is very, very it's a very teachable environment. You will learn new things every day, you will meet new people every day. Everything is moving so fast here, and then everything is moving. That's another thing. It's like one day you meet one person who comes from Australia, and the next day he or she will be gone because Singapore is just a transit city. But the knowledge that you get is probably, something that you're gonna that's something that's helped you in your current work and so on. And this is why I tell you, I told that it's very important for you to join a lot of events and everything because you're gonna meet all these nice people. And I think that openness and that teachable moment is one of my biggest strength, and also my the contribution that actually shaped to where I am right now.
Thank you. You really emphasize the word teachable multiple times. Really
I
important.
think because the reason why, because a lot of people after they finish their PhD, they're like, oh, I don't want to be teach anymore.
I just want to
Right?
teach other people.
Yeah, exactly.
So you mentioned your startup during your PhD, the startup that you founded, and then you said that at some point you were just ready to exit. Can you tell us a little bit more what you mean by exit, and what are the signs that at that moment basically you were near to close that chapter?
So the startup that when I said about nearing to exit is when it's the startup is ready to be acquired or transfer hand, right? Yeah, the liability of the company is no longer yours. You're actually selling your whole company to something else, to someone else, sorry. Exit has multiple sizes, and this is depends on your industry. Sometimes people just exit because they wanna democratize their operation line. They wanna exit because the idea has already solidified. You already at the peak of the market, and you wanna exit. And or a lot of people just you have the opportunity to merge with larger corporation, and that's why you exit, right? Another one is IPO. If you heard about IPO, like there's a lot of people, a company that goes public, and that's when you exit. But IPO exit is usually going to retain you as a CEO. But there's multiple phases of exits. And this is why the startup that we founded initially, it was an agriculture precision farming technology. So we built vertical farms with sustainable energy system that actually reduced 30% of energy consumption to produce similar amount of yields. So imagine if you have a vertical farm, you have to replace the sunlight with LED lights, replace the soil with moving water, and then this actually consume a lot of electricity and energy. So what we build is something that is energy efficient, which actually can optimize the energy consumption of your vertical farms. And then when we started the company, we thought that we're going to build farms and we're going to sell a lot of farms to a lot of people. But we realized that a lot of farmers in Malaysia, they actually do not have bookkeeping and finance knowledge. So banks doesn't want to loan them a huge amount of money to actually build this smart farming. And that's why our first year was we pivot to teaching the farmers how to do accounts,
Wow.
right? And that actually grow slowly. And then after 4 years, we realized we have enough volume of farmer to actually break even, right? With the technology that we wanted to build, and then we have enough volume of farmers who can actually apply for financing, and then after that we can break even. But prior to our break even, a larger corporation or agencies in Malaysia show their interest to acquire our company, and then this is why I said exit has multiple facets. At that point, prior to COVID. And also COVID was actually slowing down. Vertical farming or smart farming was at the peak of the market, right? At that point, everyone wanted to build their vertical farming farms. And then now it died down. So we seized the opportunity of exiting at the peak of the market. And then if, let's say, I'm still doing that company, I'm probably going to still struggle to break even. Right. But now because it has been acquired to a larger company which can scale up the technology to a scale that is economically feasible in this current market environment, we actually get a lot of how to say returns from the investment that we made 4 years prior. And I think, okay, I'm speaking like a businessman right now,
That's good.
but that is why like if you want a sneak peek on how to do it, and this is only possible when you actually, like I said just now, very analytical about market, understand what is happening around you and so on, and you can see within the horizon whether the industry is going to collapse or going to slow down, and that's when you decided to your next move. Yeah.
Thank you. You are really riding the wave of uncertainties, but you are not riding it blindly. You really know what's going
Yeah.
on, and that's how you are able to ride the wave comfortably or smoothly.
I mean, that's because we are a scientist, so we cannot
Okay.
close our eyes when we do our experiments, right?
That's true. Yeah. But now you're also doing another, like having another role outside academia, which is the director of R&D at Addiente. How did that journey start? And is a venture capitalist
Yeah,
or what
so
else?
when we already sold our startup, we have like a lump sum of money. And then we decided that at this point, we wanted to invest in a smaller companies to empower them to actually exit similar to us as well. And this is very important in an emerging economy like Malaysia, because a lot of company, when they have, like breakthrough ideas, they don't really have money to build. So, angel investor, venture capital, private equity are one of the few early people that's going to invest at the early stage of startup. And we did that because we wanted to actually empower younger entrepreneurs to do that. So, my position as a director of research and development in Addiante is a non-executive position where I'm just going there as an advisor, but rather, like an active director. Understand what are the markets and everything, and then see what are our portfolio of our investment that we did for the last 1 or 2 years and so on. And understand like whether we have to pivot, and then we have to like if is there any losses that we made or any profits that we made, and so on.
I really appreciate that the whole journey that you described, it's full of the concept of passing it on. Like you did it already, so you are You're building the next medical doctors or academic professionals, venture. You're helping the next companies to thrive and to exit. Thank you, Daniel. It's very, very inspiring to hear that.
No problem.
Shifting the topic to climate change. I see we haven't talked about that yet, but this is something that you're so passionate about, and I think it's fair to call you a climate change advocate. And you have been a UNESCO Youth Climate Action Network and climate reality leader since 2019. And I think you are now representing the region, Asia Pacific, in major meetings like the United Nations COP in Azerbaijan. And I don't even know if I pronounce it correctly. And ECOSOC, is it?
ECOSOC, Economic, Social and Development Unit.
Right, in New York. Could you share more about the work that you do for this role, and share any really share anything that you would like to share, because this is such a topic that is so close to your heart.
I have always been a passionate climate advocate because I feel like there's no point for us to live longer in a burning planet, right? I mean, there's an issue about climate since COP Paris. Everyone heard about Paris Agreement, everyone knows about Greta Thunberg, and one of the biggest industry that is affected by climate change is actually the food industry because we can't grow crop as we can last time. And one of the contributor of climate change is also food because we need a lot of land. We cleared a lot of forests because we wanted to plant more food and so on, right? And that is very dear to me because I know it's going to affect my industry so much. And then, but the advocacy is a byproduct of my entrepreneurship because when I build the smart sustainable farming, when we're focusing on making the electricity consumption to become lower and lower, that actually have a climate element to it. And then I was then invited by the World Economic Forum, the Global Shapers Community, to go to Australia to be certified as climate reality leader. And then I realized that the climate journey is something that is very appropriate for everyone, even in healthcare industry and so on. And then I tend to and then from there I actually started my own organization together with a few co-leaders around the region called the UN Inspire Alliance, which we are a group of 1,000 scientists, engineers, people who work in STEM, who are focusing on how to advise, how to build climate resilience and disaster risk preparedness in the region. And then that organization has caught the attention of UNESCO, which then I appointed as UNESCO lead, and then representing the region on our work around all this major meeting around the world. So, but what I'm trying to say is that climate is a facet of everyone's work. You can be a pharmacist and you can talk about sustainable supply chain. You can be a scientist and talk about, carbon emission and then and carbon footprint and so on. So climate is very, very prominent in our work, whether you want to look at it or you don't want to look at it, right? And now I'm working on innovation for global health issues that look into intersection of climate change and health. And that's why a lot of my work in Duke NUS is looking into how do we actually solidify health system to be climate friendly, more green, and so on. And that is something that I'm passionate about. And also I keep on working on. And as an advocate, I tend to like be on the table with a lot of relevant stakeholder to let them understand what is the importance of climate in their work and also in my work.
Thank you so much. It's a very in a way, working in life science, I don't hear people talk about climate change often.
Yes,
But
correct.
right. But now when you explain it, I feel that it's something that we just overlook or maybe ignore it on purpose, but actually it's not ignorable.
Yeah,
It's happening around, and we even feel the impact of it, honestly. If it's not just
correct.
us feeling it, then maybe families living overseas, or friends who are working in other industry, we all feel it.
Yes. Especially, like, I give you a very simple analogy. Like, for instance, like, I remember my days climbing up the hills to sales every day last time, right?
Yeah,
But
and
some
yes.
days it's just like, it's okay. Some days it's just hot. Some days it's raining. You can't even walk. Like that's in effect your mood and everything, right? And climate change is something that is very real, because if you don't take care of your environment, you can't work, right? And I'm at this point where I even pick and choose conferences that I want to go, because if I can do it online, I don't want to travel there because the carbon footprint from traveling is very, very big. So unless if I really need to go, then I have to go. But then if I can do it online, most of the call that I made, like what we have right now, is just going to be online. Yeah. Thanks to technology,
Thank you. Okay, we are coming to the end. So the last two questions, I will
though.
invite you to reflect on the past and look toward the future. All right. First question, if you could go back to the first day as a PhD student, what advice would you give to yourself?
I think to stick through it, don't break your interest in the middle of it. I broke my interest when I was like nearing my final year, because I decided to start a company. But then I think it's not a mistake, but it's also a blessing in disguise where I am, that brought me to where I am right now. But as a PhD student, if I could have stick to the course, I could have finished my PhD earlier and actually reap the benefit better. Yeah, that's one thing that I really want to remind myself, like, oh, you should have done it better.
You would advise yourself at the time to just complete the journey, but it's actually fine that your journey take longer, right?
Yes.
In
Yeah.
yeah. Last question, what kind of future do you think awaits you?
I am looking forward to be a better academician, to inspire younger people to have the same journey as myself, or even a better journey than myself. And yeah, so that's something that I look forward to. And then probably in a few years' time, I would like to go back to industry and then be a serial entrepreneur again. And during that time, probably we can have another chat.
Right, yeah, so
Yeah.
cool. And who knows, maybe after that, then you would want to come back to academia
Yeah,
again.
exactly. Yeah, it's going to be a perpetual thing.
Thank you so much, Daniel. It's a very inspirational conversation that we have today.
No
Thank you
problem.
for
Thanks,
joining us.
Kim. Thank you.
The NUS Yong Lu Lin School of Medicine celebrates 120 years of medical education this year. We thank Gene Wees for sponsoring this podcast. Don't forget to check out its website, genewees.com, when you think of next generation sequencing and gene synthesis. Follow Gene Wees from Azenda APAC on LinkedIn now. Please leave a comment with suggestions on content that you would like to listen to. Thanks for tuning in. Until the next episode.